hopefully you don't need an NT pro BNP to tell you that.
I don't know, man.
More data is good, and
do
I'm not...
Do people even do physical exams anymore?
Touche. I haven't had a stethoscope for 3 months. I'm using yours today.
Okay, happy new year, and welcome back to the Last Week in Medicine. It's been like 21 days since our last podcast, so let's not do that again.
Yeah, I haven't seen you since last year. Hey, Steven.
so long ago. Yeah, I'm Steven Jenkins, and this is...
I'm Austin Rupp. Hello.
Austin, yeah, and it's January 6th, 2020, and what a decade it has been so far.
Man, after our last episode, maybe we just take a step back.
Yeah.
It has been quite a year, though, huh?
Did you have a good holiday break?
I did. We went back to Nebraska with the dogs, family, friends, food, drink, getting stuck on I-80 on the way back.
Oh, really?
Yada, 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 yeah. We bypassed it. We had an extra 2 hours, though. But
oh, my gosh. Yeah. Rough. Did you see the new Star Wars?
I did see the new Star Wars.
What'd you think?
I liked it. It was entertaining. You know, I mean, I was a little confused at parts because,
yeah,
you know, if you don't really follow closely. But I thought that it looked cool. It was cool. Lightsaber fighting was pretty dope.
I would say as like a piece of cinema, not art, but it was very enjoyable. My kids loved it. I felt like I was watching a trailer for like the first maybe 45 minutes because it was just like moving so fast. And I was like, why do we need this dagger? Why is Lando Calrissian on that random planet?
Yeah.
There's lots of unanswered questions. But overall, it was, you know, enjoyable. And it's always nice to watch good triumph over evil.
Right.
So that was cool.
I think the biggest unanswered question is why wasn't Baby Yoda a part
right?
of it?
No, for real. No, it makes me worried. I'm like, he's probably dead. That's why he wasn't in it.
No, they wouldn't do that to us.
Well,
to you.
Did you watch the... any of The Mandalorian?
Because
they finished their first season, and the 8th episode was awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you should go and watch it.
I just need to get your username and password for Disney+.
Right, okay. Well, do you have any New Year's resolutions?
Woof. Some heavy hitters over here. Topically, I'm doing Sober January. We could talk about that later.
Oh, yeah.
But that's a mini
good
resolution.
Good for you, man.
Ski more,
okay.
Drink less in January.
That sounds like my kids. They're like, we want to play more video games this year. Like, that's their resolution.
Yeah, eat more
I think,
garbage.
You know, I just want to, like, you know, be a better doctor. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, I just want to improve our podcast.
I want to be able to critically appraise literature better. That's my New Year's resolution. And not get any fatter than I am.
That's a good one.
How's
yeah.
that? I'm going to hold the line.
But we are...
weight loss is not going to happen.
I think
but
we're in the same boat as far as, like, that's just a losing battle.
It's called aging.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Right.
Well, just a reminder, the goal of this podcast is to help you stay up to date on internal medicine. Every week, we'll share our favorite articles from the major medical journals and try to distill the big take-home points. And since it's been like 3 weeks since the last podcast, there was a lot of great stuff to review, and we've picked just a few articles. But you can check out the Twitter feed at Last Week in Med for more interesting articles.
Shameless.
Yeah, just plug in the tweet machine. Well, the first article I want to talk about is from the December 17th issue of the Annals of Internal Medicine, and it's titled Hospital-Level Care at Home for Acutely Ill Adults. And the first author is Dr. David M. Levine, and it comes from a group of doctors at the Brigham and Women's Hospital.
Never heard of them.
I think they're somewhere on the East Coast. I don't know. So we all know that going to the hospital is associated with risks, right? Like bad things can happen to you in the hospital. Falls, delirium, sleep deprivation, deconditioning. And now there's this new recognized entity, the post-hospital syndrome. And in addition, many hospitals, like ours, are running at full capacity all the time. Like last week, we set some new records.
Critical red!
At the hospital for the medical census, so that was not great. And caring for
Steven's
patients in the
right
hospital.
Now.
No, I got all my tears shed last night. I'm off service now. you know, caring for patients in the hospital is super expensive. Like one estimate was that a third of total medical expenditures in the U.S. are for inpatient care. So some places have started providing hospital-level care at home. Like apparently this is already a thing in places like Australia and Spain. So this group that did this study, they had already performed a pilot randomized controlled trial, which was published in 2018 in the Journal of General Internal Medicine with some promising results. But it was a small study, and so they decided to repeat it with a larger sample so they could reduce, you know, bias and confounding. So they enrolled 91 total patients and randomized them to the intervention, which was hospital care at home, or control, which was hospital at the hospital. And they screened 248 individuals to get those 91, but 63% of patients said, no thanks.
Yeah, interesting, huh?
They had a very specific list of conditions that were eligible, and the main categories were infections, like pneumonia, skin and soft tissue infections, complicated urinary tract infection, diverticulitis, heart failure exacerbation, asthma exacerbation, and COPD exacerbations. They also had a smattering of other random patients, including patients with complications of diabetes, end-of-life care, hypertensive urgency, and gout flares. So they had 43 patients allocated to the hospital care at home. All these patients had at least one daily visit from an internist and two daily visits from a home health nurse. And they could also get visits from a home health aide, social worker, physical therapist, and occupational therapist. And if they needed a subspecialty consult, they could get it via telemedicine. Patients were able to receive IV medications, oxygen, and get imaging and point-of-care lab tests done in their homes. They also had a small skin patch called the Vital Connect that monitored their temperatures, heart rate, respiratory rate, telemetry, movement, and falls. So move
Big
over Apple
is
Watch.
Watching.
Patients were able to communicate with their team via telephone, video, and text messaging, and the home attending was available 24 hours a day for urgent issues and visits.
This sounds like our worst nightmare. Smartphone alerts 24/7 regarding a drop in temperature of 0.5 degrees Celsius.
Exciting
stuff. No, thank you.
So the primary outcome was direct cost, which excluded physician labor because this is traditionally separate from facility billing and revenue. And so they looked at the cost of non-physician staff, supplies, monitoring, medications, labs, radiology, transportation, etc. And they found that the mean unadjusted cost was 41% lower for home patients than control patients, and the adjusted mean cost was 38% lower. Length of stay was 4.5 days for home patients versus 3.8 days for control patients. And they speculate that this may be because the clinicians experienced less pressure to discharge patients from acute care since they were already at home. And despite the longer length of stay, care at the home was still cheaper. Home patients had less imaging, fewer lab orders, and fewer consultations. And get this, home patients were less often readmitted within 30 days of discharge, 7% versus 23%. That's a pretty big reduction.
For sure.
They also looked at some safety outcomes. None of the home patients required emergency medical services or were transferred back to the hospital, which was surprising to me. Nobody died, which was also interesting to me. Rates of delirium were similar between the two. They reported that 10% of control patients in the hospital received inappropriate medications, which they didn't really define, and then zero home patients did. Home patients were less sedentary and spent less time lying down, according to their little skin patch. And despite this, though, the decline in functional status was similar between the groups, which they speculate is probably because the metrics we use for measuring functional status just aren't that sensitive, you know, to pick up small differences. So, pretty interesting study.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that we are seeing the beginning of potentially a paradigm shift here. I mean, this has been something that's been whispered about since I've been in medical training, but if internationally the model is moving this direction and we're starting to have some hard data to support it, I would not be surprised to start seeing this occur more often.
So you're going to sign up for the University of Utah Hospital at Home program?
That's the interesting thing as well. I think it would require some additional training, right? I mean, we're ingrained in our
way we do life.
Yeah.
And, very hospital-based.
We're very hospital-based in both our training and our practices, and I'm interested to know what that would look like. We have primary care docs who do home visits, and so maybe that's kind of a spearhead for this. But, yeah, it seems like a win-win.
Yeah. See, I mean, the idea is kind of romantic, you know, going to a patient's house, you, like, pull out your little black bag and, you know, do all your stuff. And you know, if you can communicate with them and all of that. I guess my biggest criticism is that the sample size probably was too small to really detect a difference in safety events. Because ultimately, that's the biggest question I have about hospital at home. Like, is it actually safe? Because it's great that it's cheaper. It's amazing that it reduces 30-day readmissions, which is like one of the holy grails. But I'd still worry about, like, what if your patient decompensates at home? Especially like these patients with respiratory problems. Like, I was surprised they did like asthma exacerbations at home.
The
like they must have been like mild asthma exacerbations. Yeah. And they do comment, like, they were very careful about which patients they selected to do hospital at home. You'd have to do patients with like a low risk of decompensation. And I think for those patients, I mean, this really could be a great option, right? Because there's a lot of benefits to being at home. They're probably going to move around more. They're going to be surrounded by their loved ones. They're probably going to eat better because they can eat whatever food they have at their house instead of like the yucky, hospital cafeteria food. So the other thing I had questions about with this Vital Connect skin patch.
Agreed.
Like, that seems like fairly advanced technology. Has it been tested in any clinical trials? And so when we talked about the Apple Watch before, which was like pretty sophisticated, could detect abnormal heart rhythms, but this little patch can supposedly detect temperature, respiratory rate, and even falls. Like, and how are we going to be monitoring blood pressures and oxygen saturation in these patients? Like, you just get like a couple data points a day from your home health nurse.
Skynet. Yeah, I agree. And I think how you frame that in their care is also sort of interesting. I mean, I really don't need continuous temperature monitoring.
Oh, that's fair.
Or, you know, a lot of this stuff. Like, you know, you get a daily therapy evaluation. Like, that's probably sufficient. I don't need to know, you know, were they on their couch or in their love seat?
You know? Well, I think one of the main goals is to pick up falls.
Sure.
And I did look up the company's website, and they have, you know, a bunch of abstracts that they've presented at conferences and things. Nothing that was really published, except the same patch was used in the previous study that this group did that was published in 2018. So anyway, yeah, I wouldn't be thrilled about like 24-hour call and all of that, but I don't know. If we had a program like that, I would think about it.
Yeah, I'd be interested,
yeah,
to say the least. And I think, yeah, just overall being able to sort of conceptualize or contextualize someone's care in their home is, you know, a huge...
Then you really know how much support they have.
Yeah, exactly. So, very interesting.
All right.
I think to dovetail with that, the fact that they had zero adverse events at home is a little...
Well, they didn't have zero adverse events. They just had... Sorry. I can't remember how many they had.
Oh, did they have some?
They still had adverse events, okay. But it was... I didn't write them down, but it was comparable between the two.
Oh, okay.
There were
Sorry.
Not more adverse events.
I misunderstood.
But there were no deaths, which I thought, and there was no one had to get emergency medical services, but there were some adverse events reported in both groups.
Well, that makes me feel better that they were being honest, because I'd like to discuss an article about adverse events. So,
nice segue.
Yeah, there you go.
That was real polished.
So this article is titled "Adverse Events Experienced by Patients Without Definite Medical Acuity." It was by Sekajima, Sunga, and Ban from the University of Washington, and was published in the Journal of Hospital Medicine. This might surprise you, Stephen, but according to the authors, physicians consider social or non-medical factors in hospital decision-making and may admit patients to the hospital without an acute medical need.
What?
Mind-blowing,
right? I never do that.
Are
you referring to the quote-unquote social admission?
That I am. So this study sought to assess if patients without definite medical acuity experience adverse events as frequently as those hospitalized with medical acuity.
Uh-huh.
So social versus real admissions. Do they experience the same amount of adverse events? In other words, can we refuse these admits?
No, I don't think
can I get an amen on that? Do we have more ammunition for refusing patients from the ER?
Oh,
yes,
my gosh.
Next article. No, so this study was a retrospective cohort study in which 300 patients were evaluated, 150 of which were defined as without definite medical acuity and 150 with medical acuity. The patients were representatively sampled from a triage database log from a hospitalist group, and I assume this is the University of Washington, but it was a, you know, regional safety net hospital.
Well, yeah, it was at Harborview.
Okay,
yeah,
gotcha.
Which is like their county hospital.
Right,
mm-hmm.
Okay. I somehow didn't catch that, so
glad
you're here. So the attending triage hospitalists received the triage calls, sometimes evaluated the patients, and as an aside, they evaluated the patients 65% of the time.
Wow,
which,
that's a lot of work for a triage hospitalist.
Yeah. So they received the call, evaluated the patients, accepted the patients for admission, and then logged them into this central database, and the medical acuity was determined by the triage physician answering the question, based on the medical reason for hospitalization, in your opinion, how appropriate is this admission to the medicine floor service? And this was all in the supplemental appendix, which I actually couldn't find, sort of disappointingly. But presumably, there were various groups within that question, but patients were only sampled from groups as, quote, without definite medical acuity and, quote, definitely medically appropriate admissions. So they were just using sort of the far ends of the spectrum, definitely appropriate or definitely social is sort of the interpretation there. So chart review was performed to capture demographics, admissions characteristics, and hospitalization outcomes. ESI and CCI were also assessed to determine acute and chronic illness.
So that's the Emergency Severity Index and the Charlton Comorbidity Index.
Exactly, yep. And adverse events were assessed by using the Institute for Healthcare Improvement Global Trigger Tool, which has been reported to identify up to 10 times more adverse events than other methods. So the tool has 28 triggers that prompted further chart review to identify an adverse event. And then two investigators investigated, and an adverse event was coded when reviewers identified evidence of a preventable or non-preventable, noxious or unintended event occurring in association with medical care with identified patient harm. And discrepancies were adjudicated, by a third reviewer. So, the most common causes or factors identified in admitting patients without medical acuity were homelessness, lack of outpatient social support, and substance use disorders. More patients without medical acuity were covered by public insurance, and more were discharged to homelessness, which makes sense. Patients with medical acuity had a lower ESI, indicating more acute illness, which also makes sense, and corroborates sort of the decisions that the physicians were making. And CCI was essentially the same between the two groups. Other demographic data were also similar between the two groups, and there were not other sort of significant differences within Table 1. So 76 adverse events and 41 admissions were identified in the group without medical acuity versus 63 adverse events and 44 definitely medically appropriate admissions. So very similar numbers, 76 versus 63. The percentage of admissions with adverse events and the rate of adverse event per 1,000 patient days were also the same and not statistically significant. The severity of adverse events were similar between the two groups, and two patients in the group without medical acuity had an adverse event that resulted in death. So social admits, no medical acuity, two died from adverse events.
I thought it was one in each group.
Two in the without medical acuity, one in the definitely medically appropriate admission. That's
yikes.
What I saw.
Yeah.
So... So, overall, patients that we consider social admits are still at risk for adverse events, including severe adverse events that can result in death. And we should take this into consideration when we're thinking about admitting these folks. A few drawbacks, the study was conducted at a single hospital. It's a safety net hospital, may not be generalizable. And the assessment of medically appropriate admission is always subjective and, sort of is up to the triage physician. But they also mentioned that, and I agree, that reflects real-world situations that we encounter.
True.
So.
Yeah, the hospital's not a safe place, apparently.
Yeah.
Like, you shouldn't want to come in.
Agreed. You'd be surprised, right?
But. Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, I thought it was also interesting that the admissions without definite medical acuity or the quote unquote social admissions were longer. Like the length mm-hmm. of stay was 6.6 days versus 6 days in the ones with a definite medical problem. So, I mean, maybe that's because you can't actually solve the problem they were admitted for.
They're here.
And so they just stay. Like if someone is admitted for pneumonia, you get them better from their pneumonia and then you discharge them. But if you admit someone for being homeless or not having social support, like you can't fix that while they're in the hospital.
Can't give them a house.
And so they end up just lingering and then bad stuff happens
exactly.
to them.
Exactly. So yeah. We shouldn't admit them. That's my takeaway.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's worth pointing out too, like the rates of adverse events were pretty close to what they estimated. Like they were shooting for like 33% was the number they were targeting, and that's what they were powered for. So I think, you know, the study was probably big enough to detect a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of a fairly small study, but right, yeah. pre-analysis.
So, yeah, so are you going to, like, pull this paper out next time someone asks you to admit somebody because they're homeless?
Heck yeah. No,
I'm just going to admit them anyway.
Yeah, I think all joking aside, it's something you should think about. You know, it's data that supports the overall hypothesis that the hospital is not a safe place and that we do cause harm. So thinking about that and remembering that is important, but that's, you know, just one piece of the puzzle.
Yeah. And if you're not homeless, we could always admit you to hospital at home.
Ew.
All right. Cool.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah, it was.
Okay, well, the next article we want to talk about is titled Preoperative NT Pro-BNP and Cardiovascular Events After Non-Cardiac Surgery, which was published December 24th, 2019 in the Annals of Internal Medicine. The first author is Dr. Emmanuel Duceppe, and this study is a nested sub-study of the VISION study, which is a very large study funded by the Canadian Institutes of Health Research looking at vascular events in non-cardiac surgery patients. So their goal is to answer the question, can NT proBNP predict rates of cardiovascular death and myocardial infarctions after a non-cardiac surgery? And so they measured NT proBNP levels in 10,402 patients getting non-cardiac surgery. And then they measured troponin levels 6 to 12 hours after surgery and on post-op days 1, 2, and 3. And then patients were also contacted 30 days after their surgery by research staff to determine whether the patient had died or had an MI. The primary outcome was composite of vascular death or myocardial injury, which includes both myocardial infarction and ischemic myocardial injury that does not satisfy the definition of MI, which I'm guessing is like the quote-unquote demand ischemia or like a type 2 NSTEMI.
Sure.
So, for patients with an NT proBNP less than 100, the primary outcome occurred in 5% of patients. For an NT proBNP between 100 and 200, the outcome occurred in 12% of patients with an adjusted hazard ratio of 2.27. For a level between 200 and less than 1500, the rate was 20.8% with an adjusted hazard ratio of 3.6. And for a level over 1,500, the rate of the primary outcome was 37.5%.
Oh.
More than a third of patients had the outcome if their NT proBNP was that high. And that the adjusted hazard ratio for that was 5.82. So, I mean, currently most guidelines recommend using the revised cardiac risk index for preoperative risk assessment. It's the most validated model, but it is limited in how well it can discriminate risk. And so these researchers compared using these NT proBNP cutoffs plus the revised cardiac risk index, compared that to the RCRI alone, and found that using these numbers plus the RCRI was more accurate, resulting in reclassifying 25.8% of patients. So, I mean, overall, I think this is an important study that will probably actually change the way I do it. I think it'll be interesting to see it validated in an external cohort, but I can't imagine anyone else will be doing a study with 10,000 patients.
Right. Vision.
So do you think you'll be checking this lab on your pre-op patients?
I don't know. I think it's a very compelling study, and I don't think there's, you know, a lot that you can argue sort of with the findings. I don't exactly know what it means clinically. You know, we have these patients quite frequently, you know, sort of ortho co-management situations. I think that's where this would be useful and where we might use it. They do talk about, you know, sort of how it would be clinically useful and how you're able to better assess risk, therefore informing operative slash anesthesia slash whatever decisions. But oftentimes what I find in these patients is I calculate the RCRI and, you know, maybe, yeah, I would use an NT pro-BNP to further inform the risk. I state the risk and they get their surgery because they broke their hip and they need their surgery.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a lot of times we're doing urgent surgeries.
Right.
And I don't think that this has maybe as much a role there, but maybe in like the outpatient setting or, you know, to inform yay or nay sort of elective surgeries.
Right.
I think it probably has a role there. But for us in the hospital, we're dealing with urgent procedures.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you should be able to assess the risk and inform patients of said risk.
Yeah.
But I don't know that it changes your plan.
Sure. I guess one scenario where I think it may would be like if you knew someone had some history of congestive heart failure and they were coming in, you know, like you said, like maybe like an elective surgery or like a semi-urgent surgery and you checked it and it was like 2,000 and you're like, wow, this person has a, you know, 37.5%, you know, chance of having some kind of event. And, you know, like I said before, like they defined the composite outcome as like even like a, you know, basically like an elevated troponin.
Right. Troponemia, which isn't real.
don't ever say that word. But that's like a pretty high risk. And so maybe you would say, well, maybe this patient isn't really optimized. Maybe we should diurese them a little bit more, make sure they're on the, you know, right medications before they head into an elective surgery, right? So, and then, I mean, some places like in Canada, apparently, they recommend checking troponins after surgery, mm-hmm. which we don't typically do, but maybe in a high-risk patient who has an elevated NT-proBNP, you check those troponins after their surgery so you can detect the myocardial injury early and see if you actually need to do something about it.
I think that's a reasonable point. I also, don't quote me on this, think that the data doesn't support a preoperative intervention in coronary artery disease, right? That's a little bit of a separate issue, but like finding an asymptomatic lesion and treating it doesn't improve.
Yeah, I'm not talking about like a PCI. I'm talking more like that person is volume overloaded. Get them a little drier before you send them to the OR.
That's completely fair. I also think clinically, hopefully, like clinically, if you look at someone and they have NT-proBNP of 2,000 and you're estimating that their cardiac or, you know, that their risk of a adverse event is 35%, like hopefully you don't need an NT-proBNP to tell you that.
I don't know, man.
More data is good. And
do
I'm not.
Do people even do physical exams anymore?
Touche. I haven't had a stethoscope for 3 months. I'm using yours today. But I think it's more data is good, and I'm never going to argue against that.
Yeah.
I think TBD a little bit for me personally, how we use it on most of the patients that we have.
I'm going to do it.
There you go. Perfect.
All right. Cool.
Do we even have NT? I think we do, right?
Oh, yeah. We got that.
Okay. Because we always just use regular BNP.
We usually check BNPs, which they comment like they couldn't really talk about because they didn't check those.
Right.
And there's no conversion factor. But all right. You got our next
more
one.
Heart stuff. Yep. So I would like to talk about this article entitled "Alcohol Abstinence in Drinkers with Atrial Fibrillation." It's by Voskoynik and colleagues.
No. Alexander Voskoynik. No, I didn't do that very well either.
I didn't think there was a B in there. Is there a B in there?
Voskoynik.
Oh yeah, you're right. Okay. So,
sorry, Alexander.
Yeah, sorry about that. Anyway, and colleagues,
mm-hmm.
Alex and colleagues,
Sasha,
from Australia. As an aside note, you know, hearts go out to Australia and the wildfires and
all those people.
Yeah, really terrible,
koalas.
Terrible stuff. Climate change isn't real though, right?
No, it's real.
Oh, okay, good. So, observational studies have shown a dose-dependent relationship between alcohol intake, incident atrial fibrillation, left atrial dilatation, atrial fibrosis, and recurrence after ablation of atrial fibrillation.
Hmm.
So, the hypothesis here was that alcohol abstinence would reduce the burden of AFib among regular drinkers with a history of AFib. And
seems solid.
Right. It hasn't been shown previously, so they figured they'd do an RCT. As an aside, did you know that 57% of American adults are regular drinkers, which means that they have more than 10 standard drinks per week?
Yikes.
Yeah.
I mean, I believe that after last week.
Totally.
Like, we were admitting so many patients with alcohol-related complications, it was out of control.
I believe it. Anyway, kind of interesting.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. So these guys recruited 140 patients from 6 hospitals in Australia, and the patients were randomized to alcohol abstinence or to continue drinking at their normal current levels. They were 18 to 85. They had paroxysmal or persistent atrial fibrillation and had regular alcohol consumption. They couldn't have alcohol dependence or abuse, coexisting psychiatric disorders, or clinically significant non-cardiac illness, which I think is interesting. Paroxysmal AFib was defined as 2 episodes within the previous 6 months, and persistent AFib was described or was, you know, defined as persistent AFib, and they had to be on a rhythm control strategy, which I thought was also interesting.
Hmm.
And patients were required to be in normal sinus rhythm at the time of randomization. So that all didn't quite jive with me, but anyway.
Well, because maybe, you know, it's hard to know if they're going to be like permanent AFib or persistent,
right,
like, unless they're in and out of it. So yeah.
That's true. So the patient or the primary endpoints were recurrent atrial fibrillation and atrial fibrillation burden, and then there were a whole host of secondary endpoints, including weight, blood pressure, symptoms of AFib, quality of life, and hospitalizations for AFib. Notably, there was a significant amount of missing data for secondary endpoints. We'll talk more about that later. And only three patients in total were lost to follow-up entirely, and they were excluded from the analysis, which I don't think you're supposed to do, but it seems like that's what they did. Maybe I misunderstood, though. It should be noted that trial was originally scheduled for 12 months but was reduced to 6 months after difficulty with recruiting and patients' willingness to abstain from alcohol.
No kidding.
Yep. So
not for me, Doc.
Yeah, exactly. The group randomized to abstinence reduced their intake from about 17 drinks to 2 drinks. The control per week, yeah, they did a really good job. The control group also mildly reduced intake from about 16.5 to 12 drinks per week. And overall, both recurrences of AFib and AFib burden were lower in the abstinence group. Recurrences, which were defined as more than 30 seconds of AFib, occurred in 37 patients, or 53%, in the abstinence group, and 51 patients, or 73%, of the control group. Time to recurrence was longer in the abstinence group, and median percentage of time in AFib was lower in the abstinence group, 0.5 versus 1.2%.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to talk about the secondary endpoints.
Okay.
It should be noted that in a post-hoc analysis, risk of recurrent AFib was higher among those who drank 1 to 9 drinks than those who abstained completely, and even higher among those who drank greater than 10 drinks. So dose-dependent, none is better than a little, which is worse than a lot.
Yeah.
Or which is better than a lot. Sorry. So, you know, overall, reduction in alcohol among regular drinkers resulted in less AFib.
That's great.
Yeah.
I'm sure patients will latch on to this advice.
Absolutely.
I mean, I had a guy this week who, like, you know, he's follows with the heart failure clinic because he has alcoholic cardiomyopathy and AFib, and he came in because he, like, passed out when he was drunk and broke his, you know, lumbar spine. Anyway, so I did tell him he should probably stop drinking, and he said, okay, doctor.
That's the right advice.
Yeah, so how's your dry January going?
So far, so good. Day 6.
Is your Apple Watch firing less often?
24 more to go, right? No, it's going well. I think it's a little cliche, but kind of like just letting the system
I actually didn't
detoxify.
Even know it was a thing.
It's a thing. It's
yeah,
a thing.
I mean, I've been dry my whole life.
Yeah, no, I think it is ammunition for, you know, less is better. Like, just try to cut back, right?
If you can just get down to a couple drinks a week, you're going to see a reduction.
Right. So
cool.
Anything else?
Well, I think we've been gabbing long enough.
Yeah, so probably.
Thanks for tuning in.
We had a lot
in.
To catch up on, though.
Yeah, there was a lot.
I'm sure they were waiting for our
I know.
2020 release.
I know, guys.
With bated breath.
Thanks for being so patient. So, yeah, that's it for today. You can find us on Twitter at Last Week in Med. If you'd like to give us feedback, please send us a message.
We don't care.
I care. Austin doesn't care. And if you enjoy the podcast, please go rate it. And more importantly, share it with your friends.
More importantly, who is B. Stoltz?
Who is B. Stoltz? Oh, yeah.
We need to know. Someone's trolling us. We need to know, yeah. Whoever you are.
Okay, bye-bye now.